From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It took just a Baghdad minute for everything to change, at least for today. At 10:26 a.m. Iraq time, the United States formally transferred power to Iraq's interim government. President Bush is attending the NATO summit in Turkey and says today is a victory for the Iraqi people and the United States.
Iraqi sovereignty is a tribute to the will of the Iraqi people and the courage of Iraqi leaders. This day also marks a proud moral achievement for members of our coalition. We pledge to end a dangerous regime, to free the oppressed, and to restore sovereignty. We have kept our word.
However, Iraqi's sovereignty means no stand down for U.S. troops and no clear end to America's commitment. Tonight on Point, the transfer of power and what it means for the United States from this day forward. We begin in Baghdad, where earlier today I spoke to Nasreen Barwari, Minister of Municipalities and Public Works for the new Iraqi interim government. I asked her to describe her emotions about today's handover.
All my feelings were very mixed. I had emotional feeling. This is a day we all waited for, but it's a day that happened also very naturally, and it should have happened right from the beginning. I mean, we never liked the occupation era or being occupied. Today is for us the beginning of the new Iraq, but all the work that was done during the past year has prepared us for this moment and will prepare us to continue the walk on the road to democracy.
But what's changed for you as a minister today as against yesterday?
Technically, we've been always in charge, so from the technical point of view, it's not much. Our change will only happen when the reconstruction program really get accelerated and we can really contribute to an improvement to the quality of life and creation of job and improvement of services. However, as an authority and as an Iraqi sovereign authority, there is a greater sense of responsibility. There is a great also potential for new ways of doing things and relying more on each other, relying more on Iraqi, and trying to help Iraqis also feel that now it's their country, it's their reconstruction, it's their democracy, and they should take more active role in the development of democracy and political process in Iraq.
But when it comes to security, you're still going to be reliant, are you not, on the 150,000 foreign troops still in Iraq?
Security will continue to need sustained support from the international community. However, Iraqi forces are already spreading around in Baghdad City. They are the ones who are leading operation to capture terrorist cells and even criminal cells. And this has happened actually in last week, where over 100 members of terrorist and robbery and kidnapping group were captured by Iraqi team. And the multinational forces were just there in case they were needed for. This is the kind of arrangement Iraqi want to have and the kind of arrangement that will succeed. However, Iraqi forces or police will continue to need training, supplies, and support. So the application of the new arrangement is yet to be sensed. However, on principle, this is the way we Iraqi want it to be, where Iraqi people are in charge of security, on guarding the street, on protecting public safety, and the multinational forces are in the background in case they were needed.
You're clearly assuming that because there has been this transfer of power, that Iraq has regained sovereignty, there's going to be a change of attitude on the part of Iraqis towards the administration, and that therefore there are going to be less attacks. Is that the case?
People are already, even since the announcement of the government, are rallying around the new government, rallying around the vision that Prime Minister Dr. Iyad Allawi has laid out, and his request and call for the public to support his effort in controlling security. We feel very strongly that things will get better. It's already having an impact. There is, of course, still a lot of work to be done before the government could establish its credit and trust among people. We still need to deliver a secure environment. We still need to improve quality quality of life and provide jobs. And that's not going to happen by us alone. That's why the acceleration of the reconstruction process is very important. Neighboring country support with border movement is very important, and intelligence information. But with every passing day, the government is taking more of a command on Baghdad Street and on Iraqi streets, and that will only get better and better.
So how much longer do you want U.S. troops to remain in the country, and what other kind of assistance are you expecting from Washington?
Well, we will need support from all countries. The United States has been very active and leading a lot of assistance support to the Iraqi people, and we're very thankful for that. We will not need the multinational force one day more than what they are needed to be around.
Which is how long?
Well, we hope that that will only take some months, hopefully between 6 months and 12 months. Iraqi army and Iraqi police forcing would be well-established and well-trained and well-supported. This is the vision. This is what our leaders are working toward, and we will try to achieve that goal.
So how should we judge the success of your government in the coming months?
We should judge it by how soon it can stabilize the security. There are some important priorities that the government has laid down today. Preparation for election is one. Before that is the setting up of the Interim National Assembly. That's a priority for the coming month. And then preparation for the census, and then preparation for the election. Around them, there will continue to be work on improving security, which is already happening with increased forces, civil defense forces, public safety forces. They are already increasing in number and taking more of a command role in Iraqi cities. By the third quarter of this year, we should see more action on the reconstruction side, too, where much of the contracts for water and road and housing is already in the process of finalization and will start in the coming months. And that will bring some good change in terms of services, but also job creation.
Minister, thank you very much indeed for sparing your time.
Welcome. It's a great day for us, and I'm happy to share it with you.
Nasreen Barwari is Minister of Municipalities and Public Works for the new Iraqi interim government. She spoke to me earlier today from Baghdad, and we turn now to Michael Ware, Baghdad Bureau Chief for Time magazine. I asked him to describe the mood on the streets of the city.
There's definitely a sense, perhaps now muted, of not quite celebration, but some sense of hope and welcome for the bulk of middle Iraq, the ordinary family with children and a house and a job and just battling to survive. They really want this country to just pick itself up and get going again. And as long as it's a government that is in some ways familiar to them and makes things work, then generally, by and large, people will be happy. So there is that sense of welcome, but there is enormous trepidation. This city has gone relatively quiet for a Monday. Most foreigners are in lockdown. They cannot leave their hotels or residences. There's been missiles fired at the Green Zone, which houses the CPA. There's been the usual just hiccups of violence and bombings in different places. There's a real tentativeness in the air right now, particularly leading up to the actual day of June 30. It's a very complex, it's a very difficult situation here as we speak.
Obviously, it's a day that is heavy with symbolism, the transfer of sovereignty. But do Iraqis feel that things have now changed?
Oh, look, on the ground, to, you know, Joe Punter, the ordinary Iraqi, there is no change. The thing that is holding this place together still remains the coalition forces, the American troops, because underpinning everything is security. We literally are rising or falling or living or dying on security right now. Yes, a government is lurching forward. This is a bold day in many ways. There are institutions, at least on paper, if nothing else, that are emerging. Even that is a development, because 2 years ago they weren't even on paper. There's a constitution and human rights, and there's a judicial system that's struggling to find its way. These are great things, but for the ordinary Iraqi, it's still American tanks in the street, it's still American planes in the sky, and they know that that's really the force that still remains to be reckoned with in Iraq.
But among US forces, is there any sense that today is going to lighten their load in the future?
Well, in the near future, it's quite the opposite. They're expecting a wave of attacks of a variety of nature. Their intel traffic suggests this, logic would suggest it, and the events of the past weeks would suggest it. So in the short to near term, if we only have limited attacks, that will be seen as a win, because they're expecting that the worst could potentially happen. Beyond that, the role of the American soldier has changed little. In recent months, they've been winding down the tempo of combat operations, trying to make the American presence here, the coalition presence here, a bit more user-friendly, pouring a bit more attention and resource into getting projects done within a military sector, to encouraging and legitimizing local councils and government bodies, to trying to assist Iraqi police to do as much as they can on their own. The combat operations only happen now when there's a specific target. You don't just go roaming so much anymore. You don't just go rousting a whole neighborhood knowing there's bombers in there somewhere. It's very, very surgical now. That's the change that will continue. But in terms of the American 1st Cavalry Division, before the handover, is responsible for holding Baghdad together. After the handover, it's still the 1st Cavalry Division. The American commander has the exact same piece of turf, the same area of operations, the same sector to keep an eye on and to keep the lid on any trouble.
Because underlying this whole strategy is a sense that the transfer of sovereignty is going to take the wind out of the Islamic militants.
Nothing could be further from the truth. You've got two wars here. One is a foreign fighter jihad war that's coming across the now open and vacant borders. By and large, that's been a terrorist war of suicide bombings and the bombings of the UN and Jordan Embassy and the JAF, these high-profile symbolic political strikes. The other war has been the daily drip feed of ambushes and bombs and mines that are plaguing coalition forces, US troops. This has largely been local Iraqi former military, particularly in the Sunni areas where it's the heartland of the resistance. They're the ones who are fighting 6 months ago, to their mind, to free their homeland. There's foreign troops in our street. Foreign soldiers frisk our women. Foreign soldiers enter our houses at night. They're locking up our cousins. We can't tolerate this. Whether they loved Saddam or didn't, happy to see him go, they also wanted to see the foreign occupier go. So they were fighting to resist that in many, many ways, and to an increasingly large degree, that has changed. These Iraqis, who once eschewed contact with the foreign fighters, in the last months had integrated with them. The financing is now foreign. So the rhetoric, the philosophy is foreign and has come in here. So what was already rich and fertile religious ground, the west of Iraq has always been conservative religiously. Some of them were prone to this, waiting for this, ready to accept this. The fact that it's now funding and guiding the resistance is another matter entirely. The difference is, 6 months ago, maybe some of these guys would have been happy with the transition to an Iraqi government. Though they believe it's led by a CIA stooge and remains a puppet of the Americans, at least it's Iraqi. Now, June 30 means nothing to the breathing, fiery heart of the resistance, because their goals have changed. The Iraqis are now telling me, the resistance fighters, I've been to their camps, their safe houses, I've met them many, many times. They want an Islamic State. 2 years ago, these guys were drinking and chasing women. A year ago, they're fighting for their homes. Now they're talking about an Islamic State and how Iraq fits in to a global jihad picture that includes everywhere from Saudi Arabia to Afghanistan to Chechnya to the southern Philippines. There's been a significant change. So to these men, handing over transition to a secular democratic government means nothing. Their fight just intensifies. They have a new enemy, a secular government.
Michael Ware, many thanks.
It's my pleasure.
Michael Ware is Baghdad bureau chief for Time magazine. We're talking tonight about today's transfer of power and what it portends for America's role and responsibility in Iraq from this day forward. What went through your mind when you heard that the transfer had taken place? How do you see America's role in Iraq after today? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about today's surprise in Iraq, the transfer of power from the U.S. to Iraq's interim government 2 days ahead of schedule. Earlier today, President Bush and Tony Blair held a joint news conference in Istanbul, Turkey, where they're attending the NATO summit. We begin with President Bush commenting on the continuing role of coalition forces in Iraq.
The United States military and our coalition partners have made a clear, specific, and continuing mission in Iraq. We'll protect infrastructure from the attacks. We'll provide security for the upcoming elections. Operating in a sovereign nation, our military will act in close consultation with the Iraqi government. Its coalition forces will remain under coalition command. Our military will stay as long as the stability of Iraq requires, and only as long as their presence is needed and requested by the Iraqi government.
Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair spoke about the historic importance of bringing democracy to Iraq.
There was a very powerful speech that was made by the President of Latvia when we were discussing the question of what NATO should do to help Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think it's sometimes a very useful reminder for some of the newest democracies in our world to tell us from a standpoint of immense moral force just what democracy means to people who have faced repression for so many years. We know the security threat we face. We know the ultimate answer to it is not just force of arms and security measures. It is ultimately the values of democracy and freedom and justice and the rule of law. And that's what we're trying to do.
We turn now to Maura Reynolds, White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She's traveling with President Bush in Turkey, where earlier today NATO leaders issued a statement of political support and an offer of military training to Iraq. I asked her what we know about the statement at this point.
Well, they're still talking about the details, but the basic idea is that NATO members will train Iraqi forces. France and Germany have balked at doing this in Iraq, and they are still holding out for doing training only outside of Iraqi territory. But the members seem to have agreed, at least in principle, that this is a task that is appropriate for NATO to take on.
And by all accounts, NATO leaders were taken by surprise by the early handover of sovereignty in Iraq.
Absolutely. The administration says that they attempted to reach coalition members, some of whom are also NATO members, to let them know ahead of time. But a large number of members are not members of the coalition. And as a result, yes, it was quite a surprise, I think, for most people here.
And were the divisions over the war in Iraq resolved at this summit in Istanbul?
Well, if you listen to U.S. officials, yes, they claim that the divisions are resolved. But even Prime Minister Tony Blair today acknowledged that, of course, there are still some tensions. It's sort of foolish to assert otherwise. That said, all sides do seem to agree that there are at least some things that they can agree on and that they would rather concentrate on those.
But I noticed that French President Jacques Chirac and the German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder very insistent that they would be sending no military instructors to Iraq.
Well, that's precisely it. Think back a few months to the Bush administration talking about asking NATO members for troops on the ground, and even just a few weeks ago for troops to help secure election posts during elections. All talk of NATO troops on the ground really has been set aside at this point, and the only thing they're talking about is training. But France and Germany are still so opposed to the idea of having any of their military forces on the ground in Iraq that they do not want their military trainers working there, only outside of Iraq, either in their home countries or in the Middle East. So clearly, there's still a great deal of disagreement over how appropriate it is for NATO to be on the ground in Iraq, even in the capacity of military trainers.
How did President Bush, though, and the British Prime Minister Tony Blair project to the other NATO leaders what had taken place in Iraq today?
What they told us, anyway, in a news conference is that the reason the transfer took place ahead of schedule was, number one, that the Iraqis were ready, that government ministries were already in their hands as of last week, but also that the prime minister made a very forceful argument that he wanted to have what he called a strengthened hand to deal with insurgents. This is particularly important this week because The United States and the other coalition members are convinced that insurgents wanted to use the June 30th deadline for the transfer of sovereignty as an occasion for attacks on coalition forces and on innocent Iraqis. And the result is that by having the transfer take place ahead of time, not only does it throw a wrench in the works of what they suspect are the insurgents' plans, but it also gives the prime minister the opportunity to impose stricter security measures that the United States did not feel comfortable imposing, things like curfews, travel restrictions, and perhaps even martial law.
Maura Reynolds is White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and is traveling with President Bush. She spoke to me from the NATO summit in Istanbul, Turkey. We're talking about today's transfer of power in Iraq and what it all means for the United States from this day forward, for the thousands of U.S. troops still on the ground in Iraq, for America's financial and moral commitment to the Iraqi people, for presidential politics, and more. Now that power has been transferred, is it time for the U.S. to pack up and go home? Does the transfer seem real or just smoke and mirrors that leave the U.S. still in deep and still in charge? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Chevy Chase, Maryland, is Dan Byman, Professor of Security Studies at Georgetown University. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us from Leesburg, Virginia, is Christopher Preble, Director of Foreign Policy Studies and the Exiting Iraq Task Force at the Cato Institute, which produced the report Exiting Iraq, Why the U.S. Must End the Military Occupation and Renew the War Against Al-Qaeda. Mr. Preble, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good evening.
Mr. Byman, if I could turn to you first, wrong-footed like so many of us, so what was your reaction when you logged onto a computer this morning and learned of this early transfer of power?
I have to confess a bit of surprise. I think I, like many people, took the June 30th deadline as inevitable, and the idea that the transfer occurred under the radar caught me a bit off foot.
And Christopher Preble, the sooner for you, the better.
That's right. I mean, I've always believed, I agree with Professor Byman in that I always believed that the handover would take place, but I also think it's largely symbolic. And so the question is not what happened today, but what happens next.
Dan Byman, the relationship now between the interim government and U.S.-led forces on the ground in Iraq, that's already been laid out by the administration and indeed by the U.N. resolution.
To a degree, yes. It's clear that U.S. forces will remain under American command. But the problem is, politically, the United States is vulnerable to the new Iraqi government. If the new Iraqi government publicly makes demands, it'd be difficult for the United States to openly defy those demands and still claim the government it has installed is sovereign. So regardless of particular agreements, there's a public platform that the Iraqis can take advantage of if they want to go against what the United States wants.
And might they make what you would describe as unreasonable demands?
Not necessarily. But what may happen is inevitably when you have the kind of brutal insurgency and counterinsurgency operations, inevitably there will be mistakes. And after those mistakes, there may be the sort of demands that U.S. forces confer first with Iraqis before acting, that certain targets are off limits, and so on. Differences that could easily become quite sharp if American commanders see it as necessary to win the war, but Iraqis see it as necessary to maintain their political stature.
Christopher Preble, you have a unique perspective. You served in the first Gulf War. There are some 150,000-plus U.S.-led forces on the ground in Iraq right now. Does the transfer make them safer, less safe?
Well, the process of drawing them back from the cities and in a very active and kind of aggressive way started several weeks ago, and so I think we have seen a decline in the number of attacks and certainly the lethality of the attacks in the last 4 to 6 weeks. Unfortunately, of course, the occupation is still there, the troops are still there, and so the insurgency is now directed at those Iraqis who are legitimately trying to just take control of their own country, but who at the same time are seen as serving the interests of a foreign power. And that's the conundrum, that's the problem for the new Iraqi government, is in striking a balance between pleasing the United States while at the same time trying to establish some kind of legitimacy in the eyes of the Iraqi people.
Let's take a call from Ray in Manhattan, New York. Ray, what did you want to say?
Yes, thank you. I sort of want to represent a more subterranean analysis of what's going on. Not that I disagree with the current speakers, but I, from my viewpoint, the politics of Iraqi war from the very beginning to the present involved politics and forthcoming election issues. And in my view, it has determined the rhetoric and policies of from the very beginning. And all of it's framed. All of it is framed in terms of good and evil, and appeals to the religious base of the Bush constituencies. And all are very manipulated toward the election outcome. And I don't believe in the long run, anyone knows what the outcome will be. But the short run is very clearly motivated, in my view, by this rather manipulated and cynical processes. I know that is I think that's a lot of people feel that, but they don't explicitly talk about it in those terms.
Christopher Preble, is Ray's view so subterranean?
Not really, but unfortunately, I wish it were that simple, and I don't think it is. I think that there was a remarkable degree of bipartisanship on the question of Iraq going back to at least the second Clinton administration, the second half of Clinton's term, believing that Iraq was a threat that needed to be dealt with. The fact is the events of September 11th provided the political impetus to do something that prior to 9/11 most Americans would not have supported. Now, I happen to believe that Saddam Hussein did not pose a threat to the United States and that therefore the war was ill-advised, and I agree that the threat of terrorism, I agree with the caller, that the threat of terrorism has in fact gotten worse. But of course, there were many people who predicted that before the war was even began, and I wish that there was more of a distinction between what Senator Kerry is arguing for Iraq and what the president is. And frankly, I don't see as much of a difference as perhaps partisans on both sides perceive.
I'd like to bring into the conversation now Fuad Ajami, Director of the Middle East Studies Program at the School of Advanced International Studies at John Hopkins University. Mr. Ajami, are you concerned that this transfer of power took place in such secrecy?
No, not at all. I mean, I think we have to be realistic about all this. First, there's an insurgency, and second, we're all political men and women. We understand that President Bush was right next door in Istanbul attending a NATO summit, and he was able to pass a note to his friend and colleague in this war, Tony Blair, "Let freedom ring," apparently the note said. So I think better to steal the thunder of this insurgency and make this transition. And if we made the transition 48 hours ahead of schedule, well, that's even for the better. It was even further proof, if proof is needed, of a certain American reluctance to stay in Iraq. A message to the Iraqis that no one really has any scheme to dominate you. The sooner you seize control of your country's destiny, the better it is for us all.
Let's hear from Amin. He's calling from Toronto, Canada. Amin?
Hi.
What did you want to ask or indeed say?
I have personal experience. I'm Afghan originally, and our experience with the Soviet Union was that the Soviet Union had at least 150,000 to 200,000 Afghan army on their side, and another 200,000 Soviet army was on their side. Like at close to 400,000 armed force they were fighting, and the people was feeling just as occupied, and there is nothing in the eyes of the Iraqi as which we see the Soviet Union at the time. And for them, the difference is the Soviet Union was more civilized. They were treating the Afghan people much, much better than American citizens, the Iraqis. So there is nothing different than the Soviet Union invade Afghanistan. The eyes of millions of Muslims is the same thing still. Nothing changed from the transfer of power.
Dan Byman, do you accept that analogy at all, the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan and the U.S.-led occupation of Iraq?
I think it's an outlandish analogy, and I think it's the kind of analogy that only someone living in the comfort of Canada could level at the United States. This has really no standing. I've traveled to Iraq. I've seen what our forces do in Iraq. I've seen the reconstruction effort. And the idea that the American conduct in Iraq is similar to the Soviet conquest of Afghanistan is ludicrous.
Let me just put that same question to Dan Byman.
I think the analogy is a bit far-fetched. I mean, there's a basic point, which is no people with a national identity like to be ruled or dominated by another people and will resist to varying degrees. But what happened in Afghanistan generated millions of refugees, hundreds of thousands of deaths, and a truly brutal occupation, even by historic standards. I really don't think the two can compare.
Christopher Pebble, give us some sense of what you understand by this transfer of sovereignty.
Well, I, as I said, I think it's largely symbolic. I think that so long as the government in Iraq is seen as dependent upon a foreign power for its very survival, for its security, and for its continued existence, it is going to be extremely difficult for that government to prove its legitimacy to the people of Iraq. Now, one of the things it can do in the very near term, it seems to me, is perhaps even in a fairly symbolic way, perhaps overturn some of the regulations that were left behind that really have nothing at all to do with American security, and that just seem to be manipulating or micromanaging the conduct of affairs inside of Iraq. For me, the bright lines for the new government of Iraq are fairly straightforward. Do not threaten the United States. Do not harbor al-Qaeda. Do not harbor anti-American terrorists. And don't threaten your neighbors. Those need to be the bright lines that everyone in Iraq needs to understand they must not cross. Beyond that, I think laying down regulations governing traffic patterns or the possession of licenses or even the certification of certain slates of candidates for various political parties, I simply don't think that contributes to our own security here in the United States. And what it does, unfortunately, is contribute to the impression that the United States wishes to dictate to the Iraqis how they're to conduct their affairs.
Fuad Ajami, the briefest of comments from you. Symbolic, though, the transfer may be, the fact that there is still a substantial U.S. military presence on the ground. Can today's handover, do you think, change hearts and minds very briefly?
Well, I think fundamentally we have changed. And I think there is even an assumption that Iraqis are not grateful for what America has done for them. Some aren't, but a huge majority of Iraq's people are grateful for it. And they will grow ever more grateful when they are convinced that we have no schemes on them. And when we convince them in the next few months that we are heading for the exits as soon as they can manage their own destiny.
Fuad Ajami, many thanks. And thanks for being with us this hour. Christopher Prebble, Director of Foreign Policy Studies and the Exiting Iraq Task Force at the Cato Institute, which produced the report Exiting Iraq, Why the U.S. Must End the Military Occupation and Renew the War Against Al-Qaeda. We're discussing today's historic handover in Iraq and what it means for the United States. Does today's transfer mean there's a light at the end of the tunnel for U.S. involvement in Iraq? How do you see America's role from this day forward? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about today's surprise handover in Iraq and what it means for the U.S., for troops on the ground, for America's moral and monetary commitment to the Iraqi people, for presidential politics. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking to Dan Byman, Professor, Security Studies Program, School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, and Fuad Ajami, Director of the Middle East Studies Program at the School of Advanced International Studies at John Hopkins University. I'd also like to bring in to the conversation now Lawrence Korb, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, 1981 to 1985, and Senior Fellow, Center for American Progress. Mr. Korb, many thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
Mr. Korb, the transfer came 2 days ahead of schedule. What do the timings say to you?
Well, timing said to me is that they were afraid to go ahead at the appointed time because they didn't have the situation under control, and they wanted to do it in a way that would not allow the insurgents to mount any type of attack. But the very fact that I think it was done in secret is a sign of how bad things are in Iraq right now.
And is the country ready to be ruled, at least in part, by the Iraqis themselves?
Oh, no. I mean, this idea that we transferred sovereignty, I mean, is a big overstatement. Basically, we transferred a limited amount of control to basically what is Dr. Brzezinski said is a satellite of the United States. And the question becomes really how is this going to work out in the next 6 or so months before we have the election?
Dan Byman, the new Iraqi government is already talking about the imposition of martial law, but it's going to be down, isn't it, to U.S.-led forces in Iraq to carry out any provisions of that legislation?
Probably not, and the reasons aren't necessarily the ones people think of. The number of U.S. forces in Iraq, by the standards of most occupations, are actually quite small. The idea that they could enforce martial law throughout the country is actually not feasible. In some very, very dangerous areas, perhaps, they would take the lead. But in others, there would simply be no choice but to rely on local Iraqis. But even in the dangerous areas, the fiction, at least, would be attempted to try to have it be seen as the Iraqis themselves imposing this. Whether that fiction could be made into reality is another question.
Fuad Ajami, do you see complications ahead in terms of the relationship between this interim government and U.S.-led forces?
To be sure, because in fact the Iraqis will be pushing for more sovereignty and more control over their own lives. I think we, for our part, should be encouraging this. There may be tensions over control of the of certain military missions. What if the Americans decide to go to Fallujah and have it out with the Fallujahans and liquidate the resistance there? Will the Iraqi government yield on this? But these really are the details. The broad outlines is our own eagerness to shed imperial burden in Iraq and the willingness and ability of these Iraqis who have come to the fore to basically reclaim their own country. And if you take a look at some of these people in this government, they're very capable people. Even Iyad Alawi, a man with a checkered background, with a Shia background, with a tremendous opening onto the Sunni apparatchiks of the old regime. Now, maybe some people who want Iraq to be ruled by angels may wince at this.
Because he's been described as a thug, hasn't he?
Well, I don't know about that one. I think he's just a very tough guy. I mean, I think that this is the kind of person that you will need for this interim administration of Iraq. This is the kind of person that Iraqi history has put to the fore.
Let's take a call from Peter in Tewkesbury, Massachusetts. Peter?
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
Very well.
Good. I was calling about a point you made earlier in your discussion about are we in a quagmire or not. I happen to think it's going to be a very bad situation for the United States in the few months coming. I think we're stuck there for quite a while. I don't think it'll be as bad as Vietnam, but I think it'll be just an awful mess. I have a cousin who was a lieutenant in the Army in a very elite unit, and he went over quite after... very soon after the invasion, all gung-ho and ready to go and do his duty. He came home several months later, just head in hand, saying, my God, you can't believe what a mess it is over there. They're getting mixed signals from the top. Different service branches are bickering with each other, and no one can seem to get it straight. They don't get any clear instruction. The guys on the ground are really running the show over there. They're not getting anything from the top until it's after the fact almost. And I think we're in some deep trouble now that the Iraqis have taken sovereignty. They're not going to be so keen to listen to us or let us take the lead. They're going to want to build their own country back, I think. And I think it could...
Okay, let me just put your point to Lawrence Korb. We keep on hearing this description of the American predicament in Iraq as being a quagmire. Is not, though, this transfer of sovereignty today the beginning of a process of extrication?
Well, we would hope so, but the United States cannot leave until you have a stable situation there. I think from our strategic point of view, we need to do that. But I think from a moral point of view, we're the ones who went in there and broke this, and we have to make sure that it's all right before we leave. I know we'd want to. When I was over there in Iraq, it did remind me of when I was a kid in Vietnam in terms of the attitude of the soldiers on the ground, because they were damned if they did and damned if they didn't. If they were nice to groups of people and the next thing you know, the people might, you know, roll out a grenade or an improvised explosive device. On the other hand, if they overreacted, they would get in trouble. And all this sense of enthusiasm, all the soldiers wanted to do was just get out of there after a year. They thought they would be greeted as liberators. You know, they were not. So I think in that sense it's similar. But I think, unlike Vietnam, where we were actually driven out by the North Vietnamese army, we have to stay there until this situation is actually stable.
Dan Byman?
Unfortunately, we've made a pretty ugly bed in Iraq, and my hope is that we can leave the country significantly better than how we found it. And simply by removing Saddam, we've gone a long way towards that. But we actually need to have a functioning government in that country. If the invasion is going to have been at all worthwhile, and I think more importantly, if we're going to keep Iraq from being a center of instability in a critical region. And as a result, we have to take measures. We may have to lower our expectations. I don't think the idea of Iraq being a beacon of democracy in the Middle East has the same possibilities as it may have had a year ago. But we have to stay in there for the near term, at least, to try to ensure some stability.
Let's bring in Gloria. She's calling from Sandwich, Massachusetts, and she wants to take issue, I think, with Fuad Ajami. What did you want to say, Gloria?
Well, first of all, I'd like to welcome you, Mr. Marshall. I often listen to you on the BBC late at night because I think you're an excellent moderator. And thank you for coming to our country. And,
well, it's good to be here. Yeah. But what did you want to say to Fuad Ajami?
What I'd like to say is I don't agree with the professor, and he's made the statement before, I believe, almost pointing a finger at the Iraqis and saying they're not grateful enough for what we've done to them. And my point of view is what we've done to them, not once but twice, is completely destroy their infrastructure, their country, and have punished them. These poor people that have been dying over the last 10 years as a result of sanctions. And now, look what we've done. I mean, how can he say that the Iraqis should be grateful when we've invaded their country and occupied their country? Not only have we lost our own boys and girls, but we continue to kill their people. And that's my comment, Julian.
Okay, Fuad Ajami, is that an accurate reflection of your view?
Well, actually, I think it's more complicated and more subtle than this. I personally favored the sacking of Saddam Hussein in 1991. I thought this was the time to do it. And I thought the Clinton years and the sanctions were a disgrace, a moral and political disgrace, because they were pathetic, because they brutalized the Iraqi people, but they did not remove the despot. So we came to this war. We came to this war after mistakes committed by Bush Sr. and mistakes and abdications committed by Bill Clinton. And we sacked this despotism. And you know what? Most Iraqis, 85% of them or so, most of the Shia, almost the preponderant majority, the overwhelming majority of the Kurds are grateful for what we've done for them. And many, many Iraqis are eager to claim this new life that we have made possible for them. So they should be grateful, and most of them, I think, are grateful.
Mohammed, calling from New York City, I understand that you're critical about the Americans in Iraq.
Well, absolutely. First, I just want to comment on what the gentleman said earlier. The mandate by the United Nations was to go into Iraq, not to get Saddam. I'm sorry, to get Saddam out of Kuwait, not to remove Saddam Hussein from power. But in addition to that, I'm a lawyer, and from a legal point of view, what the United States did was a criminal action. A criminal action. When you commit a crime, don't expect sympathy. It's that simple.
Can I just put it to you, Mohammed? Though perhaps sure. That all that is history certainly to be raked over. But today, the United States has handed back sovereignty to Iraq. What's your opinion of that?
Well, do you remember when President Bush was standing on the aircraft carrier with the banner that read Mission Accomplished? Well, I think we can draw an analogy between how significant the handover of power today was and Bush standing over there saying Mission Accomplished. It means nothing. And it's not going to mean anything. Because if I was an Iraqi, I would fight. I would not let somebody come in and tell me how to run my household. If somebody murdered my mother and murdered my children, I would fight to the death. And I think each and every one of you would do the same thing.
Lawrence, let me just bring back Lawrence Korb, a very skeptical view there from Mohammed in New York City, saying that this means absolutely nothing for Iraq. But let's just push it on a little bit further. And what does it mean in American domestic politics, do you think?
Well, I think what it means in American domestic politics is we were sold a bill of goods by the administration about how this would work. We didn't send enough troops in to secure the peace. We thought we would be greeted as liberators because we listened to Mr. Chalabi. We relied on him rather than some of the more skeptical people in our own government. We didn't plan adequately for the post-major combat phase after the mission accomplished. And because of that, we've made the situation far worse than it needed to be. And that's really the problem. When I was there in November, I saw things that I thought were not going well, and we made a report back to the Pentagon. If anything, they got worse after that, and the administration simply refused to send the right amount of troops there to get the situation under control. They thought they were going to get much more help from the rest of the world. So I think Mohammed has a point in the sense that we did bungle it and didn't make, you know, do it the right way, and we're paying part of that price. But your point is well taken. We are where we are, and the question really is what we did today. It's a step in the right direction, but boy, I would say it's only a small step, and we really need to ensure that we do it right from here on in.
Dan Byman, the Bush administration has handed back sovereignty, control, call it what you like, today to the Iraqis. Has it also handed back responsibility for whatever happens next?
I think you would like to hand back responsibility when things go wrong, but the easy answer is no. The world, Iraq, and the American people still see Iraq as America's problem and America's responsibility, and the presence of 130,000 American troops makes that quite clear that we think this too. And so there's really no way that the United States can dodge responsibility or perhaps credit, depending on what happens, for what's going to come in the next 6 months.
Fotajami, is it really now in the hands of Iraqis to determine their own future as a result of this transfer of sovereignty today?
Well, it's not quite freedom at midnight yet. I think, as both my colleagues have insisted, we still bear a great burden and we still bear a great responsibility there. My one concern about what has transpired in Iraq and what's really transpiring in Iraq right now is a certain emotional disengagement on the part of the American elite and the American public from this war. Yes, we have our soldiers there, but the elan of the war is spent. The enthusiasm for the war is spent. And we remain in this uncomfortable position that the most that we can do now is try to make sure that the terms of our exit are honorable for ourselves and beneficial for the Iraqis. It's been a very difficult and daunting assignment. I think it's been full of surprises for us all. Iraq has been a great, great bewildering story.
Mr. Ajami, many thanks. Fuad Ajami, Director of the Middle East Studies Program at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And my thanks to you too, Dan Byman, Professor of Security Studies Program, School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. And to you too, Lawrence Korb, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, 1981 to 1985, and Senior Fellow, Center for American Progress. Thanks to all of you for joining us tonight. Continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Julian Marshall, standing in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.